let fly their spears in volleys. The stout heart of the beast neither fears nor trembles, but his own courage is his death. He wheels round again and again and tries the line of men. Wherever he charges, the line gives way. So Hector ranged along his lines, hieing them on to cross the moat. But the horses would not go. They stood whinnying on the edge, for they feared that wide ditch. It could not be jumped, and it could hardly be crossed, for both banks were steep, and sharp stakes were set along the edge, many stakes, thick stakes, to keep the enemy away. A horse with a car to pull could hardly get within, but the footmen were all eager to do it. Then Polydamas came to Hector's side and spoke. "Hector and you, the leaders of our armies, it is madness to drive horses across a moat. This moat can hardly be crossed at all. The sides are set with sharp stakes, and there is a wall beyond. No chariots can go down there or fight there. The place is too narrow, and we shall only be hurt. If it is the will of Zeus Thunderer to destroy the enemy out and out, that would be just my own wish, that the Achaeans might perish inglorious, far from their home. But if they turn upon us and drive us back from the ships, and if we get entangled in that deep ditch, I do not think one will be left to take the news to Ilios. Very well, then, listen to my advice. Let our men keep the horses ready beside the moat, and let us all follow Hector in a general attack. The Achaeans will not stand if the bonds of death are really made fast upon them." This advice seemed good to Hector, and he leapt from his car in his armor. So did all the others. Each told his driver to keep his team ready in its place near the moat. Then the fighting men sorted themselves into five divisions, each under its own leaders. With Hector and Polydamas went the largest party and the best men, fully determined to break down the wall and to attack the ships. Cebriones was a third, for Hector had left a weaker man with his chariot. The next party was led by Paris and Alcathous and Agenor. The third by Helenus and Deiphobus, two sons of Priam, with Asius as third. Asius, Hyrtacus' son, who had driven his pair of tall chestnuts from the river Selleus. The fourth was under Aeneas, Anchises' son, with the two sons of Antenor, Archelochus and Acamas, both masters of warfare. Sarpedon led the allied troops, and he chose to help him Glaucus and Asteropaeus, for he thought them the pick of all others. He was conspicuous himself above all. All these ranged themselves side by side behind their shields and marched straight for the enemy, determined not to desist until they fell upon the ships. Only one would not follow the profitable plan of Polydamas, and that was Asius, Hyrtacus' son. He did not leave driver and horses behind, but took them with him towards the ships. Poor fool, he was not to escape a cruel fate. He was not to return to Ilios in triumph with horses and car. Before that could be, his unhappy portion was to fall by the spear of Idomeneus Deucalides. He aimed at the left of the camp where the Achaeans used to drive in and out. The gates were not closed and bolted, but men were holding them wide open for any of their friends who might be seeking refuge. This place he chose on purpose, followed by his party, shouting and cheering, for they thought that nothing would stop them now from falling upon the ships. Poor fools! Two of the best men were in charge of the gates, Polypetes and Leontius, both sons of formidable Lapithans. One was the son of Pirithous himself. These two stood in front of the gates like tall oak trees in the mountains, firm on their deep, strong roots, which face rain and tempest every day. There they stood firm in their strength to face the attack of Asius. The Trojans marched towards the wall with a loud clamor, holding up their ox-hides about Prince Asius, and Deamonus and Orestes, Adamas, Asius' son, Thoon, and Enomaus. Meanwhile, the two guardians from their post inside had been calling on their countrymen to repel the attack. But when they saw them beaten off and the Trojans coming on, they dashed in front of the gate like a pair of wild boars which receive a rout of men and dogs in the mountains. How they charge from both sides and crush the brushwood all round, tearing it up by the roots! What a clatter of tusks is heard until they are struck down and killed! So their armor clattered about their breasts as the blows met them, for they fought desperately, trusting in their own strength, and the men on the walls. These were throwing great stones upon the enemy, which fell like showers of hail when a boisterous wind drives the dark clouds before it. So the volleys were showered by defenders, and assailants alike, helmets and shields rang dry, battered by those millstones. Then Asius groaned and smacked his two thighs as he cried fretfully, "I do declare, Father Zeus, you are only another lover of lies. I did not think the Achaeans were brave enough to check our fury and stop our invincible hands. And here they are like a swarm of wasps or bees in a nest on a mountain path. They don't come out of their holes unless huntsmen come by, and then they defend their young ones. These men are only two, but they will not leave that gate till they kill or be killed." But Zeus paid no attention, for he meant to give Hector the credit of victory. Other parties were attacking the other gates, but I am not a god to tell the whole story, for the fire blazed all round the stone wall, and the Argives defended themselves desperately. All those gods who favored the Danaans were deeply distressed. Meanwhile, the two Lapithans were making a great fight. Polypetes ran his spear through the helmet of Damasus, and tore through the skull, and scattered the brains, so his fighting days were done. Next he killed Pylon and Orminus. Leontius hit Hippocamus through the belt. Then he drew sword, and dashing through the throng, struck first Antiphates, man to man, and laid him flat. Menon, Iamonus, Orestes, one after another he brought to the ground. While these two were stripping the slain, Hector's party was standing in doubt on the edge of the moat. This was the largest party, you remember, and the best men, and most determined to make a breach and burn the ships. But they had seen an omen as they were about to cross. An eagle flying high skirted the army on the left, holding in his talons a serpent, alive and panting, dripping blood as it struggled. The serpent curved back his head and struck the eagle in the breast near the neck. The sharp pain made the eagle drop him, and he fell in the crowd of men, while the eagle shrieked and flew away on the wind. The Trojans shuddered when they saw the snake wriggling in their midst, and took it as a portent from Zeus. Then Polydamas said, "Hector, you always find fault with me in our assemblies when I give good advice. No man of the people is allowed to disagree by any means in council or in war. He must always support you. But now, again, I will tell you what I think best. Don't let us go forward to fight these men for the ships. I think it will turn out like this omen, as surely as this was an omen meant for us. Here is an eagle flying high, skirting the army on the left, carrying a huge serpent in his talons alive and dripping blood, drops him at once and can't take him home for his young ones. Just so, we, if we do breach the wall and the enemy give way, still we shall travel back in disorder the same road, and we shall leave many of our people behind, killed in the fight. That's how a diviner of any credit would interpret this omen, if he knew anything about omens." Hector frowned at him and said, "I don't like that way of speaking, Polydamas. You know better than that. But if you really mean what you say, you have simply gone out of your wits. Forget the commands of Zeus Thunderer? Is that your advice? Forget the promise he gave me himself? Your advice is to obey a flying bird. What is a bird to me? I care nothing for birds, whether they fly east to the rising sun or whether they fly west to the darksome gloom. We had better obey the counsels of Zeus Almighty, who rules over mortals and immortals both. The only bird that's always right is fight for home and country. Fight! Why are you afraid of a fight? If all the rest of us are killed in this battle, there's no fear that you will be killed. You have not the pluck to stand and fight. But if you shirk your part, or if you try to persuade anyone else to shirk, you shall die on the spot. Here is my spear ready." So Hector led the way, and his men followed, shouting and cheering. Then Zeus Thunderer sent forth from Ida a blast of wind which carried the dust into the faces of the Achaeans. The Achaeans were bewitched by this, and it brought success to Hector and the Trojans. Trusting to his omens and his strength, they assailed the wall. They tore out the stones. They dragged down the breastworks. They levered up the buttress beams, which had been sunk in the ground to support the walls, and dragged them out. And then they expected to make a breach. But the defenders would not give way. They put up their ox hides for new breastworks, and met the enemy with volleys as they tried to climb the wall. Ears Big and Ears Little were everywhere, urging the men on the wall to resist and cheering them on. If they saw anyone weakening, they were ready with kind words or hard words. "Now, my good fellows, there's work for all, the best men, the middlings, the not-so-goods, for we are not all alike, you know that yourselves. Let no man turn his back because he hears a shout, 'Forward, all, cheer on one another!' Then Zeus Olympian, with his thunder and lightning, may help us to drive back the enemy to their city." So they went, shouting along the line, and the air was full of stones hurled by both armies, Trojans against Achaeans, Achaeans against Trojans, and there was a terrible din along the wall. It was like a storm on a winter's day when Zeus has brought up a dense cloud and showers upon mankind his volleys of snow. He lulls the winds and pours until he covers high mountains and cliffs, clover crops and the fat ploughland. Down it pours on harbor and beach and sea as far as the place where the wave beats up and stops it. But all else is covered with a heavy sheet of fallen snow. Yet the Trojans would never have made their breach had not Zeus sent his own son Sarpedon like a lion pouncing on the cattle. He held his shield before him, a round shield of hammered bronze, lined with several layers of hide, which were fastened to the rim all round with gold wire. Holding this, with his two spears in hand, he moved forward like a mountain lion, long starved and now greedy to leap into the fold and try the taste of mutton. Even if he finds the drovers there with dogs and spears defending their charge, he is determined not to leave that place without one try. Either he gets in and catches one, or the quick hand comes first with a lance. That was the spirit of Sarpedon, and he said to his friend Glaucus, "Why have you and I the seat of honor at home, Glaucus? Why have we the best portions, cups always full, and all treat us like something greater than men? And that fine estate on the banks of Xanthos, orchards and wheatlands of the best? For that we are bound to stand now before our people in the scorching fires of battle, and then the brave men in the ranks can say, 'Sure enough, there is nothing mean in our kings and governors. They eat the best meat and they drink the best of wine, but there is strength in them too, that's clear, for they always fight in front.' We must not be laggards. If to escape from this battle meant that we should never grow old and never die, I should not be fighting here in front, and I should not send you forward to win your name. But now, since whatever we do, 10,000 chances of death are about us, which no mortal man can escape or avoid, forwards, whether we are to give fame to another or he to us." Glaucus was no less ready than he, and the two marched on, leading their men. Menestheus was the man in charge of that part of the wall, and he shuddered to see them come in that grim fashion. He looked along the wall to see if one of the captains was there to help them, and then he saw, standing, Ears Big and Ears Little, with Teucros just arrived from the camp close by. But he could not make them hear, and there was such a din, the whole air full of noise from battered shields and helmets and gates. For the gates were shut fast, and the enemy up against them, trying to break them down. So he sent his herald Thootes to Eos. "Off with you, Thootes, run and call Eos, or rather both of them. That would be the best thing of all, or we shall all be destroyed here before long. The Lycian chiefs are here against us in force, and they are a real hurricane, as we know from experience. If they are pressed hard yonder, let Telamonian Eos come alone. Yes, and let him bring Teucros to do the shooting." Off ran the messenger along the wall until he found his men, and said quickly, "You, sir, my lord Telamonian, and you, sir, Oeliades, my commander begs you to come there, if only for a little while. Both of you, if you can, that would be the best thing of all, or they will all be destroyed there before long. The Lycian chiefs are there against them in force, and they are a real hurricane, as you know from experience. But if you are hard-pressed here also, at least let Telamonian Eos come alone, and bring Teucros to do the shooting." Eos was quite ready, and said without wasting words to little Eos, "You two stay here, you and Lycomedes, and take command. I will go there and support them. I will come back at once when I have done what I can for them." He set out at once with his brother Teucros, and Pandion carried the bow. They passed within the wall to Menestheus' tower, and found them hard-pressed, for the Lycian leaders were climbing the breastworks like a black tornado. The newcomers joined in, and then there was a noise. He has killed his man first, Epicles, a companion of Sarpedon. He took a huge, jagged stone which lay on the top of the heap, which was ready for use inside the breastwork. A man could not easily lift that stone with both hands, such as men are today, were he ever so strong. But Aeus lifted it high and swung it, smashed the horned helmet, and broke the bones of the man's head into a mess. The breath left his bones, and he took a header off the wall. Glaucus, in climbing the wall, exposed one shoulder. Teucros let fly at him and put an end to his fighting. He went to the rear as quietly as he could, that no enemy might notice and boast over his defeat. But Sarpedon did notice, and it grieved him greatly. Yet he did not forget his battle. He stabbed Alcmaeon, Thestor's son, and pulled out the spear. Alcmaeon followed the spear and fell flat under his clashing armor. Then Sarpedon grasped the breastwork with his strong hands and pulled it right down, leaving a wide gap where many men could pass. There, Aeus and Teucros met him together. Teucros hit the shield sling, which ran over his breast, but Zeus saved his son from instant death in that place. Aeus leapt at him and stabbed at the shield. The point did not go through, but made him stagger and check. He moved back a little bit, but he did not leave the battle, for he still hoped for victory. He wheeled about and shouted, "Men, why do you hold back? I may be strong, but it is hard for me to make a breach and clear the road all by myself. Come along, men, more hands make better work." The men were ashamed at their great leader's reproach and pushed on harder than ever. On the other side, the Argives strengthened their forces within the walls, and it was a desperate business. The Lycians were not strong enough to make a breach and clear the way to the ships. The defenders could not repel them from the wall, now that they had a footing there. It was like a quarrel about boundaries on a common field, when two men with measuring rods in a narrow space are disputing for their shares. So these two parties stood with the breastwork between them, beating over the top with shields and bucklers and fringe-fluttering leather targets. Many a thrust pierced the flesh right through the shield, or when one turned and showed a bare back. Everywhere wall and breastwork were bespattered with blood of Trojans and Achaeans inside and out. But nothing could drive the Achaeans back. The battle hung in the balance, as truly as when an honest workwoman holds her scales in hand, weight in one and wool in the other, to earn a meager wage for her children. At last Zeus gave the upper hand to Hector Priamides, who was to be first man within the Achaean wall. Hector shouted in a great voice to his men, "Up now, Trojans! Break down this wall and set fire to the ships!" All heard the cry and charged the wall in a body. In a moment they were climbing over the top, spear in hand. But Hector seized a stone that lay before the gates, thick at the butt and running to a point. Two men could not easily lever that stone from the ground into a cart, not two of the strongest, as men are now. But he managed it easily alone. Zeus made it light in his hands. As a shepherd easily carries a ram's fleece in one hand and makes little of the weight, so Hector lifted that stone and carried it to the gates. There were two tall wings, strongly built and held fast within by two crossbars moving round on a central bolt. Hector stood close, setting his legs well apart to get good perches for his blow, and drove the stone at the middle. Both hinges broke. The stone fell within by its weight. The two wings groaned, and the crossbars could not hold them, but they were thrown apart by the blow. Then Hector leapt within, his face like sudden night, his eyes blazing. Light flashed from his armor. Two spears were in his hands. No man alive could have checked that rush. He wheeled about and called his men to come on. Some climbed the wall, some poured in by the gate. The Danians fled to their ships. There was turmoil and uproar unceasing. Book 13. The Battle Among the Ships. Now that Zeus had brought Hector and his Trojans as far as the ships, he left them to hard fighting and endless misery. He turned his bright eyes away and fixed them, in the far distance, upon the horsemaster Thracians, and the close-fighting Mysians, and the proud Hippomulgi, who drink mare's milk, and the Abii, most gently bred of all mankind. He looked no longer on Troy, for he thought that none of the immortals would step in to help either Trojans or Danians. But my lord Earthshaker kept no blind man's watch. He had come out of the sea and climbed to the highest peak of Samothrace. From there he could see the whole of Ida. He could see the city of Priam and the Achaean ships. There he sat, amazed at the battle. He pitied the Achaeans in their defeat, and great was his indignation against Zeus. Down from the mountain he came in long strides. Hills and forests trembled under the immortal feet of Poseidon, Earthshaker. 3 strides he made, and the 3rd brought him to his goal, Ægae, for there is built his famous palace in the depths of the water, all of shining gold, incorruptible forever. There he harnessed the brazen-foot horses to his chariot, swift flyers with manes of golden hair. He clothed himself in gold, and caught up the whip of wrought gold, and mounted the car. Then he set out over the waves. The monsters of the deep knew their master well, and gambolled about him on all sides. The sea parted before him in gladness. The horses flew quickly along, and there was no wet on the bronze axle. Bounding over the waves, they brought him to the Achaean ships. There is a vast cave at the bottom of the deep sea, midway between Tenedos and rocky Imbros. There Poseidon Earthshaker stabled his horses and gave them ambrosial fodder. Then he shackled them with fetters of gold which nothing could break or loose, and left them to await their master's return, while he went to visit the Achaean army. The Trojans, like fire and tempest, were following close upon Hector, one roaring and yelling mass. Now they thought they would take the ships. Now they would lay low their enemies beside them. But Poseidon Earthholder Earthshaker was there, come up out of the sea to put courage into the Achaeans. He took the shape of Calchas with his great voice, and first he addressed the undaunted pair of namesakes.
Eos Telamonian, Eos Oeliades, you too must save your nation. Fight away, men, never think of flight. Indeed, I have no fear for the other places. Let the Trojans get over the wall. Our people will hold them. But I am terribly afraid something may happen where that madman is leading like a flame of fire, Hector, who boasts he is the son of Zeus Almighty. Now then, you too, may God put it in your heart to stand firm and encourage the others to hold out. Then you can keep him away from the ships, try as he may, even if the Olympian himself drives him on.
As he spoke, Earthshaker gave each a tap with his wand, and filled them with stern courage. He made their limbs light, the feet and the hands upon them. Then he left them in a flash, like a hawk which hovers a while over some lofty cliff, then darts to earth after a bird. Aeus the runner knew him at once, and said to his friend,
"That was one of the gods of Olympus, in the shape of our diviner, telling us to fight. That was not Calchas, our interpreter of birds. I knew him at once by the way his feet and legs moved from behind. The gods are easy to know. He tells us to fight, and my own heart makes me want to fight more than ever. My legs are marching underneath, my arms are moving up above."
The Telamonian answered,
"The same with me. My hands are gripping the spear, my heart is beating high, my feet are dancing along, 1-2, 1-2. I'm ready to stand alone and fight Hector Priamides at his maddest."
See the joy of battle which the god had put into their hearts. While these two were talking thus, Earthshaker was in the rear, where the defeated men were having a little rest. They lay about by their ships, exhausted by the hard struggle. It was cruel pain to see the enemy swarming over the wall. Tears filled their eyes, for they hoped no longer to escape destruction. But Earthshaker passed quickly through the ranks and tried to rally them, Teucros first and Leotos. Peneleus, Thoas, Deipyrus, Meriones, Antilochus, all the leading spirits he whipped up with reproaches and did not spare them.
"Shame on you, men! Are you only a lot of boys? You were my trust for defending our ships, and if you are going to shirk from the struggle, the day of defeat has dawned. Here, I do declare, is a miracle wrought before my eyes, a dreadful thing which I never thought to see. Trojans marching upon our ships. All this time they have been like fidgety fawns in flight, dinner for jackals and panthers and wolves, scampering about anyhow, cowards with no fight in them. All this time they would not stand up against our strong hands and stout spirit, not a bit. Now they have left their city behind. Now they fight in the middle of our camp, all because of an incompetent leader and slack followers. The men quarrel with their master and will not defend their own ships.
The enemy killed them among their own ships. Even if Agamemnon, our king, is really and truly to blame because he insulted Prince Achilles, it is our duty to fight, and fight we must. Come now, let us atone. Good men are ready to give way when the offender wants to pay. It is an ugly thing that you go neglecting your duty, and you, the best men in the army. I would not quarrel with a wastrel who didn't want to fight, but you make me indignant from the bottom of my heart. You sluggards! You will soon make bad worse by your slackness. Find a place in your hearts for shame and regret, for here is a great struggle upon us. Here is Hector fighting among our ships. Hector, the hero, has broken down our gates and their crossbars. Such was the Earthshaker's rousing speech. The battalions soon rallied about Aias and the runner, strong again now, and such as neither Ares nor Athena could decry. There the best man, the pick of the army, awaited Hector and his Trojans. Spear against spear, shield against shield, in one long fence, man pressing on man, helmet on helmet, buckler on buckler. The helmets with nodding plumes and horns touching together, so close they stood, their spears interfolded and balanced like warp and weft on the loom. The men looked straight to their front, impatient for the fray. But the Trojans came battering on in a great mass. Hector led them with irresistible rush. Like a boulder torn from the brow of a cliff by a swollen torrent which eats under the stubborn stone and sends it bounding up and down, tearing through the trees. Unswerving, it rolls and rolls until it reaches the level plain. And there it comes to a standstill and rolls no more. So Hector threatened to traverse camp and ships right down to the sea, slaying as he went. But when he met those massy battalions, he came to a standstill close against them. The Achaeans faced him, stabbing with swords and spears, and thrust him from them. He gave way, staggering. Then he shouted aloud to his Trojans in piercing tones, "Trojans! Lycians! Dardanian men of war, stand fast! Not long shall the Achaeans bar my way, although they have made themselves like a stone wall. They will yield to my spear, I think, since I am sent indeed by the greatest of the gods, the loud thundering Lord of Hera." Each man felt his spirit rise at these words. Then Deiphobus Priamides, in proud confidence, advanced with light, easy step under cover of the tall shield which he balanced before his feet. Meriones made a cast at him and hit the great oxide, fair and square, but the blade did not go through. The shaft broke off at the socket. Deiphobus braced the shield away from his body, daunted at this blow, but Meriones retired in dudgeon, both for the lost victory and the broken spear. He went away to fetch another spear, which had been left in his hut. The fight went on with incessant cries and shouts. Teucros was the first to kill his man, Imbrios, the spearman, whose father Mentor was famous for his horses. He lived in Pedion before the war and had to wife Medesicaste, a bastard daughter of Priam. But as soon as the Achaean fleet arrived, he came back to Ilios and lived with Priam, who treated him like his own sons. He had distinguished himself in the field. Teucros stabbed him under the ear and pulled out the spear. He fell as a mountain ash is felled on a far-seen summit and brings its soft leafage upon the ground. So he fell in his clashing armor. Teucros sprang forward to strip off the spoils, but Hector cast a spear at him as he came on. Teucros had kept him in his eye and dodged the cast by a slight movement, but the spear hit Amphimachus in the chest as he was entering the battle, and he fell with a thud in his clanging armor. This man was the son of Ctiotos Hectorian. Hector was advancing to pull the helmet from his temples when Aias lunged at Hector. But none of his flesh showed. He was all covered with armor, and Aias hit only the boss of his buckler. However, the heavy blow pushed him back behind the two bodies, and the Achaeans drew them away. Amphimachus was taken to the rear by two Athenians, Stichous and Menethios. Imbrios was carried off on the shoulders of Aias Telamonian and the other one. They were like a pair of lions which have torn a goat from the sharp teeth of a pack of dogs, carrying it in their jaws well above the thick bushes. So these two men carried off the dead body and spoiled it of arms and armor. Then Oeliades, in revenge for the death of Amphimachus, cut off the head and with a swing sent it rolling through the crowd like a ball. It rolled up to Hector and lay before his feet in the dust. Amphimachus was Poseidon's grandson, and his death made Poseidon very angry. He ranged through the Danaan ships and camps, spurring them on to fight and make trouble for the enemy. It happened that Idomeneus met him on his way from a friend who had just been brought in with a wound in the ham. Idomeneus had given charge to the surgeons, and he was now going to his own hut, for he meant to return to the battle. Then Poseidon spoke to him in the voice of Thoas, who was the lord of all Pleuron and hilly Calydon in Aetolia, and a man highly honored by his people. He said, "Idomeneus, my lord of Crete, where are your threats? Where are the boasts of the Achaeans against Troy, vanished into thin air?" Idomeneus answered, "No man is to blame, so far as I see, Thoas, for we all know how to fight. No one fears, no one plays the coward, no one shrinks or slinks away. This must be the pleasure of Cronion Almighty, as I take it. He wishes the Argives to perish here, far from Argos, without a name. But you were always indomitable, always rallying the laggards. Keep it up, then, and let your voice be heard." Earthshaker said, "Idomeneus, may that man never see his home again, who this day shall shrink from fight of his own will. May he be sport for carrion dogs in this place. Come on now, take your arms and come with me. We must do our best together, although we are only two, and see whether we can help. Union is strength, even with poor creatures, and we too could show fight against the best." Then he went back to join the melee, a god among the men. But Idomeneus equipped himself in the hut and took his two spears. He strode out in shining armor like a thunderbolt falling from high heaven with flashes of lightning, a portent for mankind. His attendant Meriones met him as he left the hut, for he had come back to fetch a spear. And Idomeneus said to him, "My good Meriones, why have you left the battle? Is that what your quick feet are for, my good friend? You must be wounded. Is there an arrow hurting you somewhere? Or is there a message for me? I don't want to dawdle in the hut, I can tell you. I want to fight." Meriones answered, "My lord Idomeneus, I have come to find a spear if I can. I have broken the one I had against the shield of Deiphobus." Idomeneus said, "Spear, is it? You will find one spear or 20 spears standing in a row in my hut. Trojan spears, which I take from their dead. It is not my notion of fighting to stand half a mile away, so I have quite a stock of spears and shields and shining corselets." Meriones said to this, "So have I, plenty of Trojan spears in my hut and in my ship, but all a long way off. I don't forget my duty any more than you do, let me tell you. Whenever there is a fight, there I am in front. Perhaps some of our people may not notice me, but I am sure you know it." Idomeneus answered, "I know your courage. What is the use of saying that? If the best men were being picked now for an ambush, that shows who has courage and who has not. The coward changes color, flitter, flutter. He can't sit quiet with a firm spirit, shuffles from one knee to the other, or squats on his two hams. His heart goes pitter-pat, and his teeth go chitter-chatter as he thinks of death. The brave man does not change color. He is not too much afraid when he finds himself in the ambush. He prays they may come on soon. In that case, no one could think little of your courage or your hands. If you were hit in the fight by blade or by arrow, the wound would be in breast or belly. You would be prattling sweet nothings in the front rank, not running away to be shot in the neck or back. But come on, don't let us stay talking like children, or they will be really too hard on us. Do go in and get your spear." Meriones lost no time. He got the spear and went after Idomeneus in high spirits. When Ares, the pest of mankind, marches out to war from Thrace, with panic his mighty indomitable son, who scares the strongest men to fight, they may join the Epherans or they may join the Phlegians, but they do not listen to both sides. They give the victory only to one. Such another pair were Idomeneus and Meriones, as they marched out to join the battle, armed from head to foot. Meriones said to his friend, "Where do you think we had better go, my dear fellow? Right or center? Or left? I think that is the place where they most need help." Idomeneus said, "In the center there are others to defend the ships, Aeus and his second, and Teucros, the best archer we have, and good also in a stand-up fight. They will harry Hector Priamides till he has enough of it, however strong he may be. It will be a steep climb for him to beat men like those and burn the ships, fight as he will, unless Cronion himself throw a blazing torch upon them. Telamon Aeneas would yield to no man alive if he's a man and lives on bread, if steel or stones can break his bones. Even Achilles could not beat him, that is, in stand-up fight, for Achilles could beat any man in chasing a flying foe. But for us, keep to the left, this way, and we shall soon know whether we are to win name and fame or someone else. Accordingly, they moved to the left. When the Trojans saw Idomeneus blazing in his armor and his friend with him, they shouted to one another and rushed at them all together. Then there was a furious conflict under the sterns of the ships. It was like a storm of shrieking winds when the dust on the roads is thickest, blowing up the dust in great whirling clouds. The battle bristled with spears as they hacked and killed. Their eyes were dazzled with the sheen of glittering helmets and burnished corselets and shining shields in wild confusion. Hard would the heart be that could see such a conflict without pity. Such were the calamities which the two mighty sons of Cronos brought upon the fighting hosts by their conflicting wills. Zeus willed victory to Hector and the Trojans to magnify the name of Achilles. Yet he did not desire the whole Achaean race to perish before Troy, but only wished to magnify Thetis and her heroic son. Poseidon was for the Argives. He slipped out secretly from the sea and supported them, because he was aggrieved at their discomfiture and indignant against Zeus. Yet both came of one father and one family, although Zeus was older and had more experience. Therefore Poseidon did not openly help them, but secretly, always, encouraged them in the form of a man. So the two gripped the rope of war and tugged away over both armies with strong pulls, never breaking or loosing it, while they loosed the knees of many a man. Then Idomeneus, though grizzled with years, calling his people to follow, leapt on the Trojans and drove them back. He killed Othryoneus of Cabissos, a sojourner in the land who had lately come to join the war. He had asked in marriage the most beautiful of Priam's daughters, Cassandra, bringing no marriage gifts, but promising to drive away the Achaeans by force of arms, a great feat indeed. Priam betrothed his daughter to him, and he was fighting in faith. But as he swaggered forward, Idomeneus hit him, drove his spear through the man's corselet into the belly, and he fell with a thud. Then Idomeneus called out, "I congratulate you, Othryoneus, as the happiest man in the world, if you really contrive to do what you promised to Priam Dardanides. He has promised his own daughter to you, and now hear what we would offer, and do it too. We will bring the most beautiful of Agamemnon's daughters from Argos, and you shall have her if you will join us in sacking the city of Priam. Come along to the ships, and let us make a contract of marriage. We will not be greedy in the matter of marriage gifts." Then he began to drag him away by the leg. But Asius came to defend him. He was on foot in front of his car, and the driver kept the horses close behind, breathing upon his shoulders. He fully meant to bring down Idomeneus, but the other was first, and ran him through the throat under the chin. He fell as an oak tree falls, or a poplar, or a tall pine felled by shipwrights in the forest to make a ship's mast. There he lay stretched before his chariot, groaning and clutching at the blood-stained dust. The driver was frightened out of what wits he had, and durst not turn the horses to drive away. So Antilochus pierced him also through corselet and body. He rolled out of the car, gasping, and Antilochus drove the horses away. Deiphobus now came up to avenge Asius and made a cast at Idomeneus, but Idomeneus had his eye on the man and crouched down behind his shield, a great shield of oxhide like a figure of eight with two rods to hold it in shape. The spear grazed it with a dry clang and passed over. But the cast was not fruitless, for it struck Hypsenor Hippasides in the liver under the midriff and laid him low. Then Deiphobus cried out, exultant, in a terrible voice, "Not unavenged lies Asius there, and he will be glad, I think, that I have sent an escort with him if he must go down to Hades, the keeper of the gates." The boastful words were bitter to the Argives, most of all to Antilochus. But he did not forget his friend. He straddled across the body and covered it with his shield, while two of his companions stooped and carried him away, groaning, Misistius and Alastor. Idomeneus went on wild as ever, ready to die himself or to send his enemies down into the dark. Next he brought down Alcathous, the son of King Isaetes. His wife was Anchises' eldest daughter, Hippodamia, one very dear to her parents. She excelled all her year's mates in beauty and intelligence and clever handiwork, and so she had the best man in Troy for a husband. This man, Poseidon, gave into the hands of Idomeneus. He enchanted his eyes and shackled his limbs so that he could neither move away nor move aside, but he stood still like a stone pillar or a tall tree, while Idomeneus ran his spear crashing through the corselet of bronze which had saved his body so long. But now the metal rang dry as the spear went through into his heart. He fell, and as the heart beat, the shaft quivered. Then at last Ares suffered the blade to abate its fury. But Idomeneus cried out, exulting in a terrible voice, "Shall we call that a fair deal, then, Deiphobus? 3 dead men for 1? That was your boast, I think. Well, come on yourself and stand up to me, my man. Let me teach you how true a son of Zeus confronts you. Zeus first begat Minos to be warden of Crete. Minos begat Deucalion, and Deucalion begat me to be king of broad realms in Crete. And now here I come over the sea with destruction for you and your father and your countrymen." Deiphobus hesitated whether he should try alone or go back to find someone to support him. It seemed best to look for Aeneas. He found him behind the rest nursing his everlasting grudge against Priam, because Priam paid no honor to so valiant a man. He told him his mind without more ado. "Aeneas, my noble prince, if you care anything for your kith and kin, now is the time to show it. Save your good brother. Come with me and let us rescue him. He was no more than your sister's husband, yet he brought you up from a little tot in his own house, and Idomeneus has just killed him." This aroused Aeneas, and he rushed on Idomeneus in fury. But Idomeneus did not run away like some pampered boy. He stood his ground like a wild boar in the mountains, which awaits a rabble of men in a lonely place. The bristles shiver on his back, his eyes flash fire, he wets his tusks to beat off men and dogs. So Idomeneus stood his ground, spear in hand, awaiting the assault of Aeneas. He looked round for his companions, Ascaphalus and Aphareus and Deipyrus, Meriones and Antilochus, and called to them in plain words, "This way, my friends, and help me! I am alone, and I see Aeneas coming on at a great rate. He is a terrible man, a rare killer, and he is young and strong, which is the greatest thing of all. If we were of one age, we should soon see who would win, he or I." They all came at once, and stood by him, grounding their shields and leaning them against their shoulders. Aeneas called to his own friends, Deiphobus and Paris and Agenor, captains like himself in the Trojan army, and their men followed as sheep follow the weather to water from the grass. And as that sight warms the shepherd's heart, so it warmed the heart of Aeneas to see the men following him. So they rushed into conflict about Alcathous with their long spears, and the metal of their armor rang ding-dong with the dints. The two champions, Aeneas and Idomeneus, furiously attacked each other. Aeneas cast first, but Idomeneus had his eye on him and dodged the spear. It struck in the ground, quivering. A strong throw, but a miss. Idomeneus pierced Enomaus through the plate of his corselet and split his bowels. He fell clutching at the earth. Then Idomeneus pulled the spear out of the body, but he could not strip the arms. There were too many shots flying about. His knees and ankles were not firm as they used to be, and he could not charge after his own throw or get out of the way. So he stood where he was and defended his life. He could no longer leap nimbly out of danger. As he moved slowly away, Deiphobus, who was full of undying hate against him, cast again. He missed again, but hit Ascalaphus, piercing the shoulder, and Ascalaphus fell in the dust, clutching handfuls of earth. He was the son of Ares, but Ares did not yet know that his son had fallen. His uproarious voice was silent. His strong arm was still. He sat on Mount Olympus under the golden clouds, held fast by the will of Zeus, with the other immortals who were there restrained from taking part in the battle. Now there was a general scrimmage over Ascalaphus. Deiphobus tore off his helmet, but Meriones leapt forward and cast. The spear ran through his upper arm. The helmet fell banging to the ground. Meriones pounced on him like a vulture, pulled the spear out of his arm, and ran back. Polites, the brother of Deiphobus, threw his arms round his waist and helped him out of the melee to the place where his chariot was waiting in the background with the driver. They drove him back to the city, groaning in pain as the blood ran from the wounded arm. Amid the din and confusion, Aeneas found himself opposite to Aphaeus, Caletor's son, and ran his spear through the man's throat. His head drooped to one side, shield and helmet collapsed over him, and death ravished his spirit. Antilochus watched until Thoas turned his back and lunged at him, cutting through the vein which runs up the back to the neck. He fell flat in the dust, stretching out both hands to his friends. Then Antilochus leapt on him and stripped off his armor, looking round as he did so under the shelter of his great shield. The Trojans struck at the shield from all sides, but they could not touch his body, for Poseidon Earthshaker protected old Nestor's son amid the shower of blows. Indeed, he was never free from his enemies, but turned on them again and again. His spear had no rest, but shook and stabbed forever. He was ever ready to cast or to attack. Now Adamas Asiades noticed what he was doing. He drew near and struck the shield in the middle, but Poseidon's sea-blue hair grudged the life and confounded the spear. It broke in half, and one part stuck in the shield like a charred stake, one part fell to the ground. Adamas retreated among his friends to save his life, but Meriones followed up and stabbed him between mid-nipple and groin, the most painful wound for miserable mortals in the changes and chances of war. The man bent over the spear, struggling as a bull struggles when bound and dragged with twisted ropes by his keepers in the highlands. So for a little while he struggled and gasped, until Meriones came up and pulled the spear out of his body. Then darkness came over his eyes. Next, Helenus, in close fight, struck Deipyrus on the helmet with his great Thracian sword and smashed off the helmet. It was dribbled about among the feet of the fighting men until one of them picked it up. The owner was dead by this time. This infuriated my lord Menelaus. He shouted defiance and made for Helenus, balancing his spear, and Helenus drew his bow. So both let fly at the same time, one the spear and one the arrow. Helenus hit the plate of his enemy's corselet, but the arrow glanced off as black beans or chickpeas jump off a broad shovel on the threshing floor from the winnower's fling in a stiff wind. So the arrow glanced off the breastplate and fell far away. But Menelaus hit the hand which was holding the bow and ran through the hand and bow together. Helenus escaped to his friends, dangling his arm and dragging the spear after him. Agenor drew out the spear and bound up the hand with a twist of sheep's wool, which his man happened to have with him for a sling. Now Pisandros made for Menelaus, but fate was leading him straight to his end, to be brought low by your hand, Menelaus, in that dreadful battle. They approached. Menelaus cast wide. Pisandros hit his shield. The spear did not go through, but snapped off at the socket. Pisandros was glad and thought he had won, but Menelaus drew sword and leapt on him. Pisandros pulled out from under his shield a fine axe with a long handle of polished olive wood, and they came to handy strokes. Pisandros hit the other's helmet on the end of the horn just below the plume. As he came on, Menelaus hit him with the point which pierced his forehead above the base of the nose. The bone broke, and both eyes fell bleeding in the dust beside his feet. He doubled up in a heap. Menelaus set one foot on his chest and stripped off the armor, crying out in triumph, "That's the way you shall say goodbye to our ships, I think, you presumptuous Trojans. Never satisfied with your violence after all the insults and outrage you have done to me, you dirty dogs. And you did not fear the wrath of loud-thundering Zeus, the protector of the hospitable house, who shall yet destroy your city utterly. You robbed me of my wedded wife after you had been guests in her house, and away you sailed with my wealth quite reckless. And now you want to set fire to our ships and slay us all. No, somewhere you shall be stopped. Fight as you will. Oh, Father Zeus, thy wisdom, they say, is above all, both men and gods. Yet from thee come all these things. See what grace thou showest to violent men, these Trojans, whose spirit is ever ungovernable, who cannot have enough of battle and warfare. Sleep and love are very sweet, song and dance with tripping feet. Yet a time comes when they pall. You can have enough of all. But these Trojans never can have enough of war. While he said this, he was stripping off the armor and giving it to his companions. When all was done, he went forward again to the fighting line. There another man leapt at him, Harpalion, the son of King Pylaemenes, who had come to the war with his father, but never went home to his native land. He struck the shield of Menelaus at close quarters, but he could not drive the spear through. He was retiring to shelter among his friends, glancing watchfully on every side, when Meriones let fly an arrow at him and hit the right buttock. The arrow went through under the bone to the bladder. He sat down where he was and breathed his last in the arms of his Paphlagonian comrades. There he lay stretched out like a worm, and his red blood soaked into the ground. His friends took charge of him and drove him back to the city, mourning. Behind them came his father, weeping bitter tears, and no blood price was paid for his dead son. But his death moved the heart of Paris, since the man had been his friend and host among the Paphlagonians, and he took a shot in revenge. There was a man there, the son of Polyidos, the diviner, one Eukinor of Corinth, a man both wealthy and brave. He knew well what his fate would be before he embarked, for the good old man Polyidos had told him often enough that he was either to die of a cruel disease in his own house or to fall by a Trojan hand in the great war. So he avoided two evils at the same time, the fatal disease and a heavy fine, and saved himself a great deal of discomfort. Paris hit this man near the jawbone under the ear, a quick death for him when the darkness took him. So the battle went on like blazing fire. But Hector heard nothing of it. He did not know that his people were being beaten on the left of the ships. And soon the Achaeans would have won the victory, such was the help that Poseidon Earthholder Earthshaker gave to them, by encouragement and by his own strength. But Hector kept where he had first entered the gate and broken the Danian battalions. That was the place where the ships of Eos and Protesilaus were drawn up in close lines along the shore. There the wall was lowest, and there was the most desperate contest of men and chariots. There Boeotians and Ionians, Locrians and Thians and redoubtable Epeans hardly kept off his furious assault from the ships, for he was like a flame of fire. They could not push him back and get themselves clear, not even the picked men of Athens. Their commander was Menestheus, the son of Petios, and under him Phidas and Stichios and sturdy Bias. The Epean leaders were Meges, Thylios' son, and Amphion and Dracius. The Thians were led by Medon and Podarces. Medon was a bastard son of King Oileus, and so he was a brother of Aeus. He lived in Philae, having left his country because he killed a brother of his stepmother Eriopis. The other was the son of Iphiclos Philicides. These two, then, were in charge of the Thians and attached to the Boeotians on this day. But Aeus, the runner, also the son of Oileus, would not stir one inch from the Telamonian. They stuck together as close as a pair of oxen breaking the fallow and pulling at the plough like one. The sweat oozes and trickles at the roots of their horns. Only the yoke holds them apart as they pull might and main and cut their furrow across the field to the headland. There is the very picture of big Aeus and little Aeus keeping close side by side. Telamonides, indeed, had plenty of strong men behind him to relieve him of the weight of the shield when he was tired and the sweat ran down to his knees, but there were no Locrians with plucky Oileades. They were not the men for close fighting. They wore no bronze helmets with plumes. They had no round shields or good ashen spears, but bows and slings of twisted yarn were their trust. With these they shot thick and fast to repel the Trojan battalions. So then the front ranks met Hector and his Trojans behind their armor, while the others volleyed from shelter. The Trojans thought no more of fight, for the arrows threw them into disorder. Then the Trojans would have been driven back in this ignominious way from ships and camp, but Polydamas again offered advice to his bold leader. "Hector," he said, "you are an obstinate man. You will never listen to persuasion. Because God has given you prowess in war above all others, therefore you will be wise above all others. But you can't have everything at once. To one God promises prowess in war, to another he gives an understanding mind. This brings profit to many men, this saves many, as one who has it knows best himself. Well, I will tell you what seems best to me. Here is all this ring of war blazing around you. Our people have got over the wall. Some of them stand off, armed and idle. Some still fight against odds, scattered among the ships. You should go back and summon all the best men. Let us discuss every plan, whether we should fall on the ships and trust God for victory, or retire while we can. Indeed, I am afraid myself that the Achaeans may pay back the debt of yesterday, since that insatiable glutton for war is still there, and I think he will not hold quite aloof from this battle. This advice seemed good to Hector, and he said simply, "Very well, I will go to the front and send back the chief men. You keep them here as they come, then I will come back at once." Away he went through the ranks, towering above them like a mountain, and calling for the men he wanted, who came back to Polydamas as they were told. He went on, looking for Deiphobus and Helenus, Adamus and Asius, but these he could not find. They were no longer safe and sound. Two were lying dead, slain by the Achaeans in front of the ships. Two were in the city, wounded or shot. But one he did find, soon, on the left of that lamentable battle, Prince Alexandros, encouraging his men to fight. As he drew near, he reproached him bitterly. "Damn you, Paris, you handsome coward, you woman-mad seducer! What have you done with heroic Deiphobus and princely Helenus, and Adamus Asiades and Asios Hirtasides? What have you done with Othryoneus? Now the tall castle of Troy is ruined, out and out. Now dire destruction is sure." Alexandros replied, "You are blaming an innocent man now, Hector. I may have shrunk back once from the battle, but not now, for my mother's son is not quite a weakling. Indeed, from the time when you began this attack upon the ships, we have been enjoying the society of the Danians all the time. Our companions, whom you ask for, are dead. Only Deiphobus and Helenus have gone off. I think they both had spear wounds in the arm, but Cronion spared their lives. Now then, give your orders just as you wish. We will follow with all our hearts, and I don't think fight will be lacking so far as our strength goes. But a man cannot fight beyond his strength, try as he will." He calmed his brother's mind with these words, and they passed on to the thickest and hardest of the fray, round about Cebriones and Polydamas, Phalces and Orthios, heroic Polyphetes and Palmis, Ascanios and Morus, two sons of Hippotion, who had come from Ascania in relief the morning before. Then Zeus gave them spirit to fight. They moved like a tempest of stormy winds that swoops on the earth under the thunder of Father Zeus and mingles with the waters amid tumultuous noise, the waves dashing and splashing over the roaring, seething sea, curved and crested, first one line and then another line. So rolled the Trojans on, first one serried line and then another line, a sea of metal flashing and crashing as they marched behind their leaders. Hector Priamides was in front, looking like man's evil genius, the god of war himself. Before him he held his well-balanced shield, made of thick oxhide and overlaid with bronze. On his temples was a shining helmet with nodding plumes. At every point he tested the opposing battalions, advancing under cover of his shield to see if they would give way. But the Achaeans, undaunted, stood their ground. Aias first came striding out and challenged him. "My dear man, come close. Why do you try to frighten Argives? That is useless. We are not unacquainted with battle, although the cruel scourge of Zeus has humbled us. I doubt not it is your hope to destroy our ships, but we also have hands to defend them. Before that, I tell you, that noble city of yours is like to be taken and sacked by our hands. For yourself, I say, the time is near when in flight you shall pray to Father Zeus and all gods that your horses may be swifter than falcons and carry you into your city over the dusty plain." As he said this, a lucky bird appeared on the right, an eagle flying high. The Achaean army took heart at the omen and cheered loudly. Then Hector answered, "What nonsense you do talk, Aias, you blundering lout! I wish I were as certain to be the son of Zeus Almighty with Queen Hera for my mother and to be worshipped like Athena and Apollo, as this day now here is certain to bring ruin for the Argives one and all. And among them you shall die yourself if you dare to face my long spear, which will tear your lily-white skin. You shall feed the carrion dogs and vultures of Troy with your fat and your flesh as you lie in front of your Achaean ships. Then he led the way, and his people followed with loud cheering, while all the army behind cheered loudly. The Achaeans raised their answering cheer and stood to await the Trojan champions ready for the contest. The noise of the two hosts resounded to the glorious heavens of Zeus. Book 14. How Hera deluded Zeus and sent him to sleep, and how in consequence the tide of battle turned. We left Nestor in the hut over his wine. Although he was busy with this, he did not fail to hear the uproar outside, and he said to the wounded man bluntly, "Machaon, my dear sir, what do you think is going to come of all this? There's more noise over there by the ships with these young hotheads shouting. You just sit and drink your wine until Hecamede warms the water and washes your wound. I'll find a gazebo somewhere and have a look round." He picked up the shield of his son Thrasymedes, which lay in the hut. He had taken his father's, and chose a good sharp spear and went out. But standing where he was, he could easily see the shameful sight, the wall knocked down, and men in rout, and Trojans chasing at their heels. The old man's mind was now heaving blindly like the sea when it purples with a long groundswell, foreboding the shrill courses of whistling winds, but uncertainly, for the waves do not roll forward either way until some decided blast comes down. So he was in doubt between two, whether to join the Danaan mass or to seek out King Agamemnon. At last he decided for Agamemnon and left the men killing each other, while the hard metal cracked and rang under the dint of swords and spears. On his way, Nestor met the princes who had been wounded coming up from the ships, Tydides and Odysseus and King Agamemnon, for their ships were a long way off from the battle, drawn up in lines near the sea. But they had run the first ships high and dry, and the wall had been built close under the sterns, for no beach, however wide, could have held all the ships, and the army had not much room, so they had arranged them in lines and filled the whole width of the shore which the headlands of the bay enclosed. The princes, then, were coming up together, leaning on their spears, to see how the battle was going, and they were deeply despondent. There the ancient man met them and filled them with consternation. Agamemnon said, "My lord Nestor Nelides, why have you left the battlefield? Why are you here? I fear that terrible Hector will fulfill the boast he made to his Trojans, that he will never return to Ilios until he had burned the ships and killed us all. That is what he said, and here it is, coming true. I do declare the whole nation have a grudge against me like Achilles, and they will not fight even before the sterns of their own ships." Nestor said, "Yes, here it is plain before our eyes, and not even Zeus Thunderer himself could undo it. The wall is in ruins, and we thought it would be an impregnable defense for ships and men. Here's the battle beside our ships, no rest, no pause. Stare as hard as you like, you can't tell which way the Achaeans are being driven. Nothing but a muddle, and men being killed, and the noise resounds to heaven. Do let us consider what is to be done, if wits are any good. But the battle is no place for us. A wounded man cannot fight." Agamemnon said, "Nestor, there they are, fighting close under our ships. The wall we built was of no use, nor the moat where everyone worked so hard. We did hope it would be an impregnable defense for ships and men. But it must be the will and pleasure of Zeus that the Achaean nation should perish, far from Argos, without a name. I knew it when he was ready to defend the Danaans. I know it now when he magnifies the enemy as if they were very gods and shackles our hands and spirits as he has done. Well then, this is my advice. Let us launch the first ships that lie near the sea and moor them afloat by anchor stones and wait for the blessed night, if that will make them cease fighting. Then we can draw down all the other ships. Yes, to flee from trouble is quite right, even if you flee by night. Better fight and run away than tarry to be caught next day." Odysseus said to him with a frown, "Curse you, Atrides. What a saying to let slip between your teeth. I wish you had some other army to command, some contemptible army instead of us. Zeus, it seems, has given us from youth to old age a nice ball of wool to wind, nothing but wars upon wars until we shall perish every one. Is that how you mean to leave the great city of Troy for which we have suffered such hardships? Be silent, and let no other Achaean hear these words, which no man ought to let pass his lips if he knows what decent talk is like, much less a sceptered king, and one who is at the head of all these nations that you are lord of. What you said just now seems to me simple nonsense. Here, in the middle of battle and war, you tell us to launch our ships, that you may give the enemy their heart's desire. They are victorious already, and you want to destroy us utterly. For our men will not keep up the fight while the ships are being launched. They will be always looking behind their backs and slinking to the rear. Then your plan will destroy us, most potent captain.
Agamemnon answered, "Oh, Odysseus, you have cut me to the heart by that cruel reproach. If the people do not wish to launch the ships, I do not ask them to do it. I only wish someone could tell us of a better notion. Let him be young or old, I should be glad indeed."
Then Diomede spoke up. "The man is near. We shall not have far to look, if you will only listen and not be offended because I am the youngest in this company. But I come of good blood. I am the son of Tydeus, who lives in his grave in Thebes. I am descended from Portheus, lord of Pleuron and Calydon. He had three sons, Agrius and Melas and Oeneus, my father's father, the most valiant of them all. My father left home and settled in Argos by the will of heaven. He married a daughter of Adrestus. He had a rich estate, plenty of wheatlands, plenty of orchards, plenty of flocks and herds. He was the most notable spearman in the nation. You must know whether I tell the truth. So you cannot call me low-born or weakling as any reason for disregarding what I say. Come on, let us go to the battlefield. If we are wounded, we can't help that. We must keep out of range ourselves, or it may be one wound upon another. But we can rally the others and encourage them. I mean, those who please their temper and would not fight." All agreed to this, and Agamemnon led the way to the battlefield. But the famous Earthshaker kept no blind man's watch. He saw them go, and went after, taking the shape of an old ancient gaffer. He took hold of Agamemnon's right hand, and said in plain words,
"Your Grace, now I guess Achilles is right fain in that cruel heart of his, when he sees blood and rout among us, for he has no sense in his head, not a jot. May he be damned so, may God whistle him down. But that, Arit, the blessed gods bain't angered wi' thee, not they. Do bide a bit, and thou'st see yon good lords and captains dustin' across the plain to home."
Then with a great shout he scampered away. The voice of Lord Earthshaker sounded from his chest as loud as the noise of 9 or 10,000 men shouting in hot battle, and every man of the Achaean host, as he heard, felt the strength increase within him to fight on and never yield. But Queen Hera stood on a peak of Olympus, watching. She knew him at once, her own brother and her husband's, and glad she was to see him so busy in the battle. She saw Zeus, also seated on Ida among the mountain brooks, and a hateful sight, she thought him. She began at once to scheme how she might beguile him, and this seemed the best plan. She would prink herself out for a visit to Mount Ida, and entice him to lie by her side in love, so that quiet and balmy sleep might drown his eyes and mind. So she went to her chamber, which her own son Hephaestus had built for her, with doors closed by a secret lock which no other god could open. She closed the doors, and first she washed every speck and stain from her lovely body with a bath of ambrosia. She anointed her body with oil, ambrosial, soft, scented with perfumes. Do but stir it, and the fragrance fills the whole palace of Zeus, with its brazen floor, heaven above and earth beneath. She combed her shining hair, and plaited long ambrosial braids to hang from her immortal head. About her she draped an ambrosial robe, which Athena had made so smooth, and embroidered with beautiful patterns. She fastened this with golden pins at the breast. She put a girdle round her waist with 100 dangling tassels, and hung in her dainty ears earrings with 3 mulberry drops, delicate and graceful. She spread over her head a new and beautiful veil, white as the sunlight, and upon her feet she laced her shapely shoes. When all was done, she issued from her chamber and called Aphrodite apart to tell her a secret. "Will you do something for me, dear child, if I ask you? Or are you too angry with me for favoring the Danians, and will you say no?" Aphrodite replied, "Say what you want, my gracious queen. I will do it with all my heart, if I can do it, and if it is doable." The artful queen answered, "Give me now your charm of love and desire, with which you subdue both mortal men and immortal gods. I am about to visit the ends of the earth to see Oceanus, the father of the gods, and Tethys, their mother. You know they took me from Rhea's hands and brought me up and cared for me in their own house, at the time when Zeus all-seeing thrust Cronos down below the earth and the unvintaged sea. I want to see them and make up their old standing quarrel. They have been at odds for a long time, separate in bed and board, because of some grudge or other. If I can persuade them and bring them together again, as loving as before, they will love me and make much of me forever. Aphrodite said with a smile, I could not say no to that, and I ought not, for you sleep in the arms of Almighty Zeus. So saying, she took out of her bosom the broidered strap with all the charms worked in it. There is love, there is desire, there is lover's tender prattle, the cajolery which deceives the mind of the wisest. She dropped it into Hera's hands and said, Here you are. Tuck this into your bosom, this embroidered strap in which everything is worked. I do not think you will fail in winning your heart's desire. Queen Hera smiled with her lips and her limpid eyes, and smiling, she laid it in her bosom. Aphrodite returned into the house, and Hera sprang from the heights of Olympus. One step to Pieria, one step to Emathia. She sped over the snowy mountains of the Thracian horse masters, stepping on the topmost peaks, for her feet did not touch the level ground. From Athos she stepped over the sea to Lemnos, the realm of princely Thoas. There she met Sleep, Death's brother, and grasped him by the hand as she said, My dear Sleep, you are the lord of all gods and all mankind. This is not the first time you have done something for me. Listen to me once more, and I will be grateful to you all my days. Lull me the bright eyes of Zeus under his brows as soon as I shall have lain by his side in love. I will reward you with a fine throne, incorruptible, made of solid gold. My son Crookshank Hephaestus shall make it with all his best craftsmanship, and a footstool underneath to rest your soft feet upon while you drink your wine. Sleep answered, My most gracious and honored queen, any other of the immortal gods I could easily put to sleep, even the stream of Oceanus, who is father of all, but Zeus, Cronion, I would not dare to come near, nor could I put him to sleep unless he should himself command me. I have learnt a lesson from your requests once before. That time when the ambitious son of Zeus sacked Troy and sailed away, then I did indeed lay the mind of Zeus Almighty by drowning him in deep slumber. And you made a dangerous plan. You raised a tempest upon the sea and drove Heracles far away from his friends to Kos. When Zeus awoke, he was very angry and knocked the gods all over the place. But he wanted me, most of all, and if he had found me, he would soon have got rid of me, thrown me out of heaven into the sea, if Night had not saved me. She can tame both gods and men. I took refuge with Night, and by he was pacified, for he was loath to offend Night. And now you tell me to do another desperate thing. Queen Hera said again, with a look from her limpid eyes, My dear Sleep. Why do you worry about all that? Do you think Zeus will be as angry about Trojans as he was about his own son? Look here, I will give you one of the young Graces. You shall woo her and wed her. You shall have Pisithia, whom you have always wanted.
Sleep was delighted and said, Very well. Swear me an oath by the inviolate water of Styx, touching Mother Earth with one hand and the glittering sea with the other. Call to witness the gods below with Cronos, and swear on your honour that you will give me one of the young Graces, Pisithia to wit, whom I have wanted all my days. Hera swore the oath as he asked, and called to witness all the gods under Tartarus, who are called the Titans. When the oath was finished, the two passed swiftly through the air, clothed in mist, leaving Lemnos and Imbros behind, on their way to Ida, mother of wild beasts, among the mountain rooks. They left the sea at Lectos, and passed over the dry land with the treetops waving under them. There Sleep waited before Zeus could see him. He took the shape of a whistling bird,
which the gods call Chalcis, but mortals call Semindis, and he perched on a lofty pine, tallest of all the trees which then grew on Ida. It pierced through the mists into high heaven. There he stayed, hidden among the foliage. Hera walked quickly up to Gagaras on the top of Mount Ida, and Zeus, cloud-gatherer, saw her come. When he saw her, what love filled his heart! He felt then as he did when first they mingled in love, that time when they had gone to bed and their parents knew nothing about it. He rose and stood before her, saying, "Why, Hera, whither away so fast? What brings you here? I don't see the chariot and the horses." His artful queen answered, "I am going to visit the ends of the earth. I want to see Oceanus, the father of all the gods, and their mother